The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning. You're listening to Campus Voices on 91.3 WVUD.
I'm Allison Delaney with Liz Webb, and today we're going to be talking about gender in the workplace. We're joined by three professors of management from the University of Delaware's Lerner College of Business and Economics, Wendy Smith, Amanda Ballou, and Kyle Emick, and Professor Jessica Edwards of the English Department.
So today we're going to talk to them about gender in the workplace. We'll start off with you, Professor Emick. We were talking off the air about your friend who made you aware of the struggles that women face in the workplace. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I think as a man in the workplace, a lot of times you're blind to a lot of these issues. And I know I didn't really start noticing them until I heard anecdotes from friends and started researching it myself, honestly. So I had one friend that I'd known ever since I was growing up. We were in elementary school together. She's always been a great student, went to Columbia Law School, got a great job on Fifth Avenue at a big law firm. And the one thing she had told me, so I used to bring her into my class back when I taught at Fordham University to talk to the students. And one thing that came up throughout the discussion was, she said, you know, I was prepared to be black in the workplace, but I was never prepared to be a woman. And then she talked about the culture, and that's a very masculine culture she was in, but still facing a lot of issues that I wasn't really aware of at the time.
That story illustrates the principle of intersectional feminism, right, Professor Edwards?
Yes, thanks for having me on. Intersectionality was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a critical race theorist and scholar and lawyer. And it's a framework that allows people to better see stories that and experiences of people of color and marginalized people. She uses the term to bring out how gender and race are interlocking or interconnected, and how they help us to see multiple sort of levels of injustice, and how we should be creating and understanding more nuanced stories. So the framework affords us a prism to see how people who are, say, maybe both black and a woman, or have disabilities and they're a woman, so how these particular issues intersect so that we can see a little more varied information about how they are impacted by all of these particular forms at the same time.
Have you heard from your experience, have any female students and alumnae come up to you and told you about their experiences in the workplace after graduating, and what did they find surprising about entering the workplace or their experiences?
Yeah, this is Wendy, and again, thanks for having us on, and thanks for doing this show. I think these first two stories bring out two big ideas about these issues in the workplace. The first is the story that Kyle told, which is just how surprising it is when you enter the workplace what these biases look like, because they're not necessarily obvious. And I can remember in my own story, having gone through high school, having been in a youth group that was kind of like Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, separate women and men, a lot of opportunity for women to succeed. There was a lot of opportunity for girls to succeed in my high school. And then entering into college and starting to be awakened to, but not really until I got to the workplace, what it looks like to have these kinds of biases come out in the workplace, what kinds of comments we might expect, what kinds of expectations or issues there might be. And it's things that are subtle, like I remember having somebody assume that I wasn't interested in a position that my junior male colleague was interested in because I might be interested in having a family, and that might lead me to prevent me from being in that position. And so those are really subtle comments, subtle and nuanced comments, and I'm sure we can sort of, as we go on, expand on what this really looks like. And I think that speaks to one of the things that my colleague Mandy Ballou here, who we have started Women's Leadership Institute, Women's Leadership Initiative at Lerner, and has spoken with a lot of the students in Lerner's amazing Women in Business RSO. And one of the things that we're often amazed by is the limitations on which current students just don't see or are naive to or unaware of or just don't get how much bias there is out there and what that might look like. And I don't think that we want to tell a story to these students that say, look, it's all doom and gloom, but I do think it's important to be aware of and start learning about these kinds of biases or this kind of inequity so that we can start developing from it.
And to add to that, this is Amanda Ballou. I was a little naive assuming that if a female student joined the Women in Business Club, it was because this understanding of gender inequity was there. And if I think back, a lot of the reason they joined the club was to network with other female students and to learn about how to dress for interviews and, you know, very practical kind of career things. And if you think back to when I was a student in college, it didn't occur to me either, you know, and back in the 90s, it didn't occur to me either that there was gender inequity and that there was anything unfair. I noticed it, you know, I noticed gender roles in my family when I was growing up, which bothered me as a, you know, a kid. But I always just thought that was how my parents did things. I didn't realize that there was a broader world. And I had a similar story when I was at my previous university. And these things are very innocent. Usually people don't mean to be rude or offensive, but I met someone at a networking event of faculty and, oh, are you the dean's or the president's assistant? I think we've met before. And I said, oh, no, I'm a faculty member. I have my degree and I'm teaching here. And I wasn't offended, but I could immediately see how this gentleman was just really embarrassed that he had just felt like he had accused me of being a secretary. And that's what I looked like because I was younger and there weren't as many women there. So as those little things happen, whether or not we get offended by them, we start to kind of see those differences. We start to see how we're different. And you had asked about alums and women executives and women that have gone beyond being students. And when we talk to women, Wendy and I work with women executives in a leadership development program, and they'll say things like, it wasn't really clear to me until I moved up higher levels of leadership and it got more and more lonely. You know, I realized there aren't very many women like me around here. So those kinds of things come out as you progress. And that's one of the things we're working on with this Women's Leadership Initiative is the inequity in leadership.
And I think one of the reasons that what Wendy and Amanda are saying is that a lot of these biases are natural. So people have limited cognitive resources, so they need to make quick decisions as they go about their day. So if I ask you to think about what did you eat for breakfast, you're likely to say, I ate the thing closest to me, or I ate what I ate yesterday. It wasn't this effortful process of saying, what are all the options in my house? Let me choose this for breakfast. So when it comes to people, we have the natural tendency to socially categorize them based off of characteristics that are obvious to us. And some of the most obvious ones are race, gender, age, things like this. And I think the reason that I want to make this point is that it's really an effortful process to try to overcome these biases since they are so natural. You see someone, you take your view of them, match it to a schema you already have in your mind of the way people in that position or of that look should behave. And it's difficult to sort of overcome that. So being aware is really a big first step in the process.
And I think that's why diversity is so important, right? Because it will disrupt what we perceive as natural, right? So this idea of categorizing, this idea of sort of being comfortable becomes way more nuanced, which is where in some ways intersectionality comes in, right? So when I know for instance, for me, I've been mistaken for help before, not necessarily read as a faculty member because of the way that I look. And so, you know, in some ways, when we think about what we perceive as normal, it's so important to have different voices, different conversations, different people at the table so that these sort of innocent conversations, which end up becoming really, really important conversations about race, about what it means to be a professional, even what it means to be a woman professional, what it means to be a male professional, interacting in a space that is supposed to be inclusive, how all of these things sort of coalesce and how in some ways, maybe diversity is not the right word, but more and a more inclusive culture might be possible if we sort of are able to disrupt what is natural.
I just wanted to add to what Jessica is saying because around this notion of intersectionality, because we started off the conversation about gender in the workplace, mm-hmm. and really you could expand that conversation to inclusion in the workplace. one of the problems with focusing on diversity isms is that sometimes those isms get pitted against one another, and we don't want to do that. And to Jessica's point, not only that, first of all, racism is a problem, sexism is a problem, and so are other isms. And the more inclusive your workplace can be, the more you accommodate all of those. And as a second point, this point about intersectionality is that indeed there are biases against women in the workplace. There's the biases against people of color in the workplace. And those biases come together to make it even worse for women of color in the workplace. And so there's a new study that was put out by McKinsey and Lean In Together that we can you can Google and find online, Women in the Workplace 2017. And they really show how any kinds of limitations that there are for women are even more difficult for women of color. And so again, the more inclusive of an environment we can create, the better we are for all around.
These are really interesting points, and Kyle very eloquently pointed out the cognitive issues here. And I teach organizational behavior. And so with my students, when I talk about diversity and bias, I specifically make the point that, hey, you know, we're human. This is the way our brains process information. And our brains kind of, you know, they can be a little lazy or they can cheat, and what's most readily available or in various different ways is where these biases come from. And Jessica makes a really good point that adding more diversity to leadership roles and, you know, areas that are dominated by certain groups is a really good way to kind of help the brain not have to think so deliberately. If those things are there and it's more normalized, then bias can somewhat be naturally reduced. And in order to do that, a more inclusive approach to how we interact with one another and hire people into jobs in the workplace and so forth is really important.
So we're talking about the natural or implicit biases we have as humans, but where does it go in the workplace from nature to nurture in the culture of such workplaces and the issues it brings with isms of all types?
Well, I can start with sharing a piece of research that really captures this idea. Several years back, a professor at Columbia University had brought a case about a venture capitalist, a female venture capitalist, to his class. And his class hated this woman. She, you know, called her all kinds of names and considered her to be really the kind of leader they wouldn't want to follow. And so what he did was he took the exact same case and just switched the gender pronouns and the names. And so this was Heidi Rosen in Silicon Valley. It switched to Howard Rosen and gave one case to one class and one case to a second class, and then asked them to evaluate this leader based upon their competence, based upon how talented were they, and then also based upon how likable they were, how much people would want to work for them, et cetera. And as his students, as they evaluated this professor, thought that both Heidi and Howard, again, the same case, were both equally competent and equally talented. But then when you asked what they thought about this person in terms of their likability, Howard was much more likable. People wanted to work for Howard much more than Heidi. And a piece of this story that we should, you know, that's important, is that the kicker to this research is that if you look at who liked or didn't like Heidi, all people liked Heidi less than Howard, but the people who really didn't like Heidi were the other women. And so I think there's a couple things that this story shows. First is that the way that we think about gender roles, or the way that we think about race roles, as Kyle was saying, are categorized in our mind. And often we don't even think about it, that when we think about leaders, we might, you know, a white man might come to mind more than a black woman, or more than a white woman, or even more than a black man. It's just that's how we are socialized to think about these things. And then that socialization leads us to behave in ways to create more opportunities for these folks, to assume that they're going to be moving into these positions, to listen to them more. And so it's these implicit biases that they show, and this is what we mean by implicit bias, they're not always conscious to us, and that we all hold them. Women hold biases against women just as much as men do. We all hold these biases, and getting to understand that, I think, is a first real important step.
This is a really interesting point, that gender inequity, if we stick specifically to that topic, is not a male-only problem. And it's not only men that are biased against women. Yeah, it's very much so. And this is globally. I mean, if you look at patriarchal societies where women are married off and they move over to the male head of house, you know, to the husband's family and so forth, it's often the mother-in-law or the other female members of the family that are just as prescriptive with how she's supposed to, you know, live her life as the male, her male family members are. So, and the same thing goes in the workplace, you know, now. It's called role incongruity theory. This idea that the person in the role doesn't necessarily match our perception of what the role is supposed to be.
I think Kyle's recent research, actually, Kyle, I would pull you into this conversation because I think your recent research is a great demonstration of this.
Yeah, so I can talk about that. And there's one thing I wanted to say first as well, too. And that was just, so this kind of gets at the point of what Jessica was talking about earlier with having a diverse workplace. So when you're talking about making changes, it comes from two places. One is having a diverse workplace because people have these implicit perceptions of which people should fit which roles, as Amanda was saying. So seeing someone outside of that causes cognitive dissonance. I'm sure this is a term that everyone's heard before. So you see something that is mismatched with the way you perceive it should be. So what do you do in that situation? You can either look at that person as an outlier or you can change your perception to be more inclusive. So if you have a workplace with only one woman, one minority, it's unlikely you're really going to change your implicit bias. So having a very diverse workforce can help to change that. But on the other side of it, there's lots of people who say, you know, I understand I'm a minority. I understand I'm being looked at, so I'm going to be a model citizen. And they can live their whole life being one example of a anti-bias for one person, but they don't see any systematic change. So the other side comes from the top down, which is what we're talking about, which is why representations of women and minorities in things like the media and things like movies, TV, is so important. And some people try to make it a side issue, but where a lot of these implicit biases really come from are these societal expectations that come in a top-down fashion from the way the society expects people to behave, as opposed to an individual level changing individually.
We're speaking with professors of management from UD's Lerner College of Business and Economics, Wendy Smith, Amanda Ballou, and Kyle Emick, and Professor Jessica Edwards of the English Department.
So I can talk about that research quickly, if you want. So I just concluded a study with my colleague Sean Martin from Boston College, Elizabeth McLean from University of Arizona, and Lieutenant Colonel Todd Woodruff from West Point, looking at the biases that may affect whether or not women get into positions of leadership. So our first sample was a military sample, cadets at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. They run an annual competition with military academies from all over the world. And we looked at their teams and we surveyed them and we asked them a few questions. So one question we asked them is, you know, how much are you speaking up? How much are you giving your opinions to the group? Another question we asked is, how much do you respect this individual? So they rated their teammates. And a third question we asked is, now on these 10-person teams, if you were to rank everyone from 1 to 10, who do you want to lead the team if you're going to do the competition again? Who would you want 1, 2, 3, all the way to 10? And what we found is that men who spoke up, especially with new ideas for change, the way teams should change to have positive outcomes, would receive more respect from the team, and they were more likely to be seen as leaders in the future. And women weren't. So as an example, men who spoke up significantly above average were likely to be seen as a 2 out of 10, so the second most person that people wanted to lead the team. Women speaking up the same amount were likely to be seen as an 8. So almost at the bottom. So this is a very significant effect size for any social science researchers. A 6-point difference on a 10-point scale is huge. It's one of the biggest I've ever seen. So then we tried to replicate it with MBA students. You could say, you know, the military is a very male-dominated context, which is true. Perhaps there's more male bias there. However, there's a similar number. So there were 16% women in our study. I believe upper-level managers in Silicon Valley is at about 18%. Law firm upper-level managers is similar, so there's a lot of similar contexts. But anyways, we wanted a more representative sample. So we went to MBA students, we went into sales, which was about 50% men and 50% women. And in this case, we had a man and woman, they're actually married, say the same exact thing. And we had students rate them on their leadership ability. And we found, again, the man who was speaking up with positive ideas for change was more likely to be rated as being respected and was more likely to be rated as a better leader. And the reason for this gets to what Wendy was saying before. If I ask any of you listening out there to think of a leader, I can almost guarantee you'll think of a man, and I can probably guarantee you'll think of a white person too. So we have these implicit perceptions in our mind, and the male's behavior matched with what people already saw as being a leader, and so they were more likely to be like, yeah, that's a leader. And with women, there was this conflict there. So they were less likely to resolve it by saying that she should be a leader.
This issue of something as basic as the voice, the gender of the voice, has been shown at Babson College with entrepreneurship research. Venture capitalist funding is more likely to go to a guy than a girl, even if they have the exact same pitch.
Yes, I'm really, really interested to hear these things because it makes me think about really the importance of the structural change, right? So I'm really happy to hear of Wendy and Amanda's group with bringing in a group that helps women to kind of think through ways to become, I guess, more effective leaders in the workplace. And then Kyle's idea of bringing out the importance of creating more systemic change, that makes me think about the importance of language and how language is really important to how we, again, begin to think about ideas of inclusiveness, about ways to better engage faculty, students on campus, and how clubs, organizations, these really cemented pieces or structures in our campuses might help us to create more progressive change.
I want to add, because I think Jessica's talking about systemic change and structural change, and all of those are really important, and I think they all have to happen. And I think that we also have to think about the more micro-level change. Now, they have to go together, but I think we can't, like, and here's what I mean by that. If I go back to Kyle's example, there's structural things that can be done, but it's also these, like, micro-behaviors or microaggressions where we feel the nuance of this disparity. And so here's what I mean. To add to Kyle's data, there's studies, for example, that are done where you take the exact same resume, you put a male name on top and a female name on top, or you put a traditionally Anglo name on top or a traditionally African-American name on top, and you ask people, would you give these people a job? Same exact resume, and you find that people would give the job to the white male. Or a recent study was done where a teacher taught an online class without their face being shown, and either presented with a male pronoun as the professor or a female pronoun as the professor. And as a male pronoun, same exact class, same content, same teacher, same style, the teaching evaluations were much higher for the male pronoun. Or there was a great blog about a woman in the workplace who basically swapped emails with her male counterpart for a week because the hypothesis, which proved out, was that the interaction she had with clients over email had a very different tone to them if she was taking on her own email with her female name or took on a male name. And all of these things are examples. I mean, I don't want to just overstate the doom and gloom. We can get to what do you do about these, because there are things to do about these. But all of these things are examples of the micro behaviors or microaggressions that come from, again, sometimes a very sometimes conscious, but sometimes a very unconscious place where we just treat people differently because of who they are, because of their identity. And I think that part of the solution has to be recognizing that and trying to address these kinds of behavioral changes.
The student evaluations of faculty shows over and over and over again a bias. Female faculty tend to be rated much more harshly than their male counterparts, even if they're doing great work. And really interesting, the other day, both Wendy and I were forwarded a study that somebody did. Another scholar put out, you can put in certain keywords with all of this data from ratemyprofessor.com on faculty evaluations. And there's certain words that you can put in there that show extremely skewed results based on whether the professor was a male or a female. It's fascinating. Like the word condescending was largely a word that was used for females. And there's certain negative words that are used for females that aren't used for males. It's really interesting. And that's male and female students. I mean, that wasn't split only.
This website was created by a professor named Ben Schmidt at Northwestern University. And you can just Google that and find this website to see the data.
What are some of the initiatives that the University of Delaware is doing for students to combat this?
Well, we can talk about the initiative that we're personally involved with at the Lerner College. The Women's Leadership Initiative is very new. We just branded it and gave it a formal name this coming summer. We're having an official launch on March 8th. But that initiative is led by the Lerner College of Business and Economics, but it is campus-wide and it reaches all student, faculty, staff, community, executives outside of the university too. The mission statement or the mission of the initiative is to enhance learning that propels transformational women leaders and advances gender equity in the workplace. And we aim to do that more than we already have with a very multifaceted approach. That means speaking engagements with panels, women leaders. That means inviting and encouraging our male students to come, that this isn't only women-only work that we're working on. That means working with faculty on content in the classroom. Are there enough women examples and guest speakers? Are there women in the case studies the students are looking at? You know, really looking at all aspects of where all of the things we've been talking about are coming from and how they're perpetuated.
In addition to this, there's a number of initiatives on campus that UD, it should be very proud that we are an awardee. We got a grant from the National Science Foundation for a program called ADVANCE, which the program focuses on advancing female faculty and providing the support for female faculty. And I think that one of the pieces of this is that as we support female faculty, we create the conditions where we have mentors, advisors, and potential for more female students. And
right.
Maybe you can build on that.
Which is a very... Again, a systemic sort of move. So we're trying to change the culture for sure. I'd add to ADVANCE, the Vice Provost for Diversity is also doing quite a bit of work with having chief diversity officers in each college. And they also work to help to bring more awareness and, of course, more structural change and also micro changes, hopefully, to our university. I'd also pub the group that Stephanie Kirschbaum is a part of called, or the leader of, at this present moment, called the Faculty Achievement Program. And it's helping to, again, create those spaces for not only women, but faculty for sure, just be successful. And so that's an important thing to remember. And of course, there are also faculty caucuses, like the Women's Caucus and other groups that help to support initiatives that hopefully create more diverse spaces, again, provide more structural change.
We also have a very active Women and Gender Studies department. I know I've started hearing just through students that are telling me the sororities are doing a lot on these kinds of issues. We actually even have, and I haven't gotten in contact with them, but we have a men's group. It exists for these inequality and not just biases, but violence against women. And I have a feeling it's a student chapter of a larger organization called MAN, the Men's Action Network, and it's related to these things. So there's quite, and that's just a couple. I'm sure there's more we're not thinking of.
As a female who will be entering the workplace eventually, and I'm sure other female students would like to know what your advice is for female students entering the workplace. Do you have any advice for what to expect and how to kind of deal with these problems? And even for male students entering the workplace, how they can help to ensure that this culture isn't perpetuated?
As a technical writing professor, I always encourage students to think about how they brand themselves. So to think about particularly branding in relation to inclusive excellence. So how do you see yourself as a person going to a company? How will you in some ways add to that company culture with the idea of inclusiveness in mind? So I try to help students to think about that because we are becoming a more and more diverse culture. So how do you as a person think about the history that shapes you and then also be aware of the many people that will be coming to the workplace with you? So I really, really encourage, I would encourage students to think about themselves in relation to the world through the lens of inclusive excellence. How do you see yourself in that way?
Our time is up, but we'd love to have you guys continue the discussion in another episode of Campus Voices.
That'd be wonderful. We'd be happy to continue talking.
Definitely.
Thank you, Professor Edwards, Smith, Ballou, and Emick.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.